We would be happy to entertain questions, but before we go there, I wanted to thank each of our speakers. You were each absolutely wonderful and held a very separate piece of this wisdom about sleep, so thank you so much. I want to remind you that Ariel Schwartz is heading up an absolutely wonderful panel in January, that would be January 22nd, and she has called it resiliency, being flexible in a changing world. And she has speaking with her Tom McSheehy, Heather Fliege, and Will Vanderveer. And those of you who were here for our initial trauma panel will remember Will as an amazing speaker, and the other two are lovely as well. And Ariel's right here. She's an exquisite psychologist. And so please come back to that. So we'd love your questions, if you wish.
I've been struggling with insomnia for decades, as did my dad, as did does my sister. It seems to run in our family. And I recently read an article that was quite comforting to me to not think there's one perfect way to sleep, that we all have our own sleep rhythms. I fall asleep easily, a couple hours, wake up, and then I wake up every couple of hours, and then the last part of the night, I sleep really deeply for maybe 4 hours. And I'm trying to now accept that this is perfectly fine and normal. So does that sound good, or should I be seeking medical help?
I'll take that. I think it sounds great. The best thing you can do is accept your own rhythms. I think the field of sleep medicine does a disservice by making rules of how people should sleep. If that works for you, embrace it and be thankful for it.
Do you feel rested in the morning? What time are you awakening? Okay. And are you napping as well? Are you drowsy today? That's not necessarily abnormal. So as far as wakefulness, you're fine. Attention and mood, you're okay. So, you know, the way I kind of look at this, as long as there's no daytime impairment symptoms, it suggests that you're probably getting refreshing sleep. Sleep maintenance insomnia, difficulty staying asleep, sometimes can be suggestive of secondary insomnia. So if you're not someone who's having trouble falling asleep, it suggests that you have no problems with your mind taking off and having difficulty controlling it. Maintenance insomnia might suggest something else provoking it. So things that do that, periodic limb movements of sleep, do you snore? So if you're awakening every couple hours, what could be happening is you might be going into dream sleep. And during that time, the airway collapses because the brain is paralyzing the airway intentionally. It does that intentionally, so we don't act out our dreams. It paralyzes all the musculature of the body except for the diaphragm and the extraocular muscles. So REM sleep occurs, you know, every 90 to 120 minutes. So that might be why you're awakening every 2 hours, potentially. Just a thought. So
we have another question here.
How do sleeping pills affect sleep, and how does coffee affect sleep?
So don't think of sleeping pills as one sort of homogenous thing. It depends on what neurotransmitter system they work through. I'm not a big fan of GABA medications like benzodiazepines. That basically works the same way as alcohol does, except they're longer lasting. Generally not good for sleep long term. Ambien, Lunesta, Sonata also kind of fall into that group, but they're sort of weaker GABA agonists. So if you use them sparingly, they're probably not too bad. Then there's a whole other groups. You know, there's antihistamines, which histamine is a wakefulness-promoting agent in the brain, and you're basically blocking that. Antihistamines can actually have their place if you use them properly. And then serotonin-type drugs, mirtazapine, trazodone, these kinds of things, old tricyclics, tetracyclic, they tend to be more my preferred medications that I would use with patients because they don't have as much rebound insomnia. You don't get as much tolerance to them. Risk of addiction is low. A lot of people have concomitant mood disorders, so using those with that can be helpful. A lot of psychiatrists nowadays are using dopaminergic drugs, which I'm also not a real big fan of either. I don't use them in my practice generally. So
I just want to comment that Mark used a term with you, sleep maintenance insomnia, meaning you people who don't sleep deeply and keep waking up. This whole thing Rohini mentioned and Andrew mentioned and I mentioned about sleeping with your awareness inside your body. Neurologically, that will help you sleep more deeply. And if you wake up, just, you know, what we talked about, just use that. It'll help you get back to sleep more quickly. But here's the key. Don't pressure yourself to get to sleep, back to sleep really quickly, gently and slowly.
Thank you. That was a good closure on that, too. Shelley, great question about medications. It's as though I seated you to ask it. It's really important because that's a big question out there, and particularly in communities like Boulder where medications are vilified. When it comes to sleep and somebody hasn't been sleeping long enough and all the stuff that they're doing isn't working, then I become Malcolm X, and Malcolm X said, by any means necessary. So so I'm, you know, I really use the medications that I feel are relatively benign to break the cycle, because the more you don't sleep, the more you don't sleep. And then slowly, when that person is sleeping, I'm able to bring them back to the gentleness of awareness. So that's one thing. The second question of caffeine is, if you're a somebody who has a tendency to have a great deal of movement in your life, you don't need caffeine. If you're having trouble sleeping, whether it's falling asleep, staying asleep, or quality of sleep, I would frankly just come off of the caffeine. Conventional medicine says please don't drink caffeine in the afternoon. Stick to maybe 1 to 2 cups in the morning, and I'd even get off of those.
One of the issues with caffeine is, you know, the half-life of it is usually 4 to 6 hours in the average person. So that's how quickly half of it is broken down. So you take 200 milligrams when you awaken. 4 to 6 hours later, you still have 100 milligrams in your system. 4 to 6 hours later after that, you still have 50 and 25. Pharmacologists tell you it takes 4 to 5 half-lives to get a drug out of your system. So you're looking at 16 hours for the average person, which is about right, if you have right when you awaken. On oral contraceptives, that half-life can go up to 10 hours, the half-life. So now you're talking 40 hours to break it down. Other drugs that interfere with the breakdown of caffeine can really be a problem. So you can be stacking your caffeine. If you have coffee every morning and you're not breaking it down within 24 hours, that means each day you're actually building it up a little bit until you seek steady state after 4 to 5 days. So you have to really look at the pharmacology of it. Decaffeinated coffee, it's just decaffeinated, but it's not destimulated. So there's a lot of other, plants just don't make caffeine. They have a metabolic pathway that makes caffeine plus a lot of other molecules that look almost exactly like caffeine. The manufacturers only have to remove the caffeine. So you've got theobromine, theophylline, beta-phenethylamine, all these other stimulants. So
chamomile.
Pardon me?
Chamomile.
Chamomile?
Yeah, I said
coffee. Oh, I can't give you a good answer on that. I don't know of really any good, you know, placebo-controlled trials looking at that. So,
due to what affects most mainly in old age, I wake up 1 or 2 times a night to go to the bathroom. I accustomed myself to do it in the dark, but sometimes I'm not able to go back to sleep.
I know this sounds like a broken record, but just try what's on the card and see if it, not to get instantly to sleep, but see if it helps a little bit. Maybe not, but try it.
Well, this happens to be my current job. I work with, you're too young for me, but I work with people in their 90s who are getting up a lot at night. And this is, I see this very frequently in both sexes, but very frequently in women, where there's some level of urinary incontinence and an urge incontinence where you really can't hold back when you need to go, and so you have to get up. And I'm just going to address that because it is to use the bathroom that we get up. And if, as we get older and we find that we need to get up to go use the bathroom, I would find no embarrassment in using Depends so that I would not have to get up and go to the bathroom. It's a fairly simple way of decreasing all of that movement in the middle of the night, which also increases the risk of falls. There are, of course, medications to stop that process, but every medicine, as we know, is a poison at a certain dose for somebody. So this is the advice I have for you.
So I think when people get insomniac, they can reach the point of desperation. So here's a technique if you are desperate. Here's a technique that if you are a little bit desperate that may be worth playing with. And Rohini hinted at this. Massage. If you're in bed, you can actually massage your feet, massage the bottom of your feet. Because as she said at the outset, where your attention goes, the prana goes. So whether we believe in these inner energetic systems, and we don't have Western methodologies to actually confirm these yet, in the Eastern traditions, these are commonplace. I mean, Tibetan medicine, Chinese medicine, I mean, so many different schools of medicine work with these energies. So you can literally rub the bottoms of your feet to bring those energies down. The other thing you can do, it's a wonderful term in the meditative traditions, and I love it, it's called subterranean samadhi, where you visualize two black pearls, a black pearl at the sole of each one of your feet. So it's just worth playing with. I mean, these techniques are definitely worth experimenting with without getting too kind of cognitive about it. It's worth playing with.
Just out of curiosity, the volume of urine that you're having at night, is it the same as what you have during the day, or is it a smaller amount? Yeah, so the urine, when you go pee, is the amount of pee the same as it would be during the day, or is it smaller amount?
No, it's the same.
It's the same. So the question always comes in my mind is, are you peeing incidentally because you have awakened? Some people will do that. They'll just awaken for some other reason, and then they'll just empty their bladder because, hey, I'm up, might as well empty it. And usually you can tell if they're doing that because it's a smaller volume of urine. In your case, you're peeing twice, which isn't necessarily abnormal. It depends on your lifestyle and fluid intake and things like that. If somebody gets up to like four times a night, I start being concerned about other medical conditions. In fact, sleep apnea is not very well known, but it can actually cause nocturia and cause you to pee at night. And the way it does that is actually kind of interesting, because sleep apnea is where your airway collapses, right? So if your diaphragm is contracting down, it's pulling down, creating negative pressure in your thorax, and you've pinched off the inlet valve, now you've got all this negative pressure that's not being relieved. So the heart actually expands circumferentially under those conditions. And the stretch receptors in the wall of the heart think they're getting too much blood, because that's what they're there. They're there to gauge how much blood's coming in and to adjust the blood volume. So what they'll do with sleep apnea is they'll actually send a peptide down to the kidneys to make you pee to reduce the blood volume, thinking that's the problem, when actually the problem is you have sleep apnea. That's not the case with you, because I don't think you're having enough nocturia, but somebody that's peeing four times a night, if you've ruled out other causes, sleep apnea, if they snore, then definitely look for sleep apnea. Just
the problem of prostate that affects
Yeah, prostate can do it, fluid, kidney issue, there's a lot of things, the blood sugar levels. So all of those things would need to be checked out.
Hi. How and why can the tea, even with not caffeine, affect produce nightmare? So the tea, when you drink tea, my example, when I drink tea after 4, even if it's with not caffeine, immediately I'm in nightmare during the night. Why?
It's just, it's promoting wakefulness during sleep. So what's happening is you're awakening during either stage 3 sleep or REM sleep. You're having arousals because you're having fragmented sleep from the caffeine, which is not allowing the normal brain processes to happen during sleep. So I wouldn't do that anymore. Pardon? Well, the caffeine, as I mentioned, the same thing with caffeine. With tea. If you remove the caffeine, there are still other compounds in there that have wakefulness-promoting properties.
Is there such a thing as being a morning person and a nighttime person? And
what's normal?
This is kind of related to what we're, my presentation. The majority of people out there are adjustable, in my opinion. So, and I think, well, I don't mean just the majority, I mean the overwhelming majority. I think in the high 90s, there are some people who have genetic variants in which their clock genes, the genes that control that internal clock, have actually aberrant proteins, so it's either slower or faster, and it really throws them off. I would argue that those people are still they can respond to outside time-setting mechanisms like light and these kinds of things. So I've taken people who are night owls and converted them to morning people. As long as they follow, it's hard to follow the regimen, but if you do it, you can become that. So it's just a matter of adjusting the internal clock. Somebody who's constantly going to bed at 2 a.m. and awakening, you know, at 10 a.m., there's nothing broken. I mean, they actually have a normal rhythm, right? I mean, they're pretty consistent, you know? Problem is they'll get into bed at midnight and they'll lie there for 2 hours thinking, I have insomnia. They don't actually have insomnia. They just are trying to go to bed at the wrong time. So if, you know, if somebody had normal sleep and went to bed at 10 p.m. and awakened at 6 every day, and you said, hey, I want you tonight now to go to bed at 8 p.m., they're going to lie there in bed for 2 hours and have insomnia, but they don't actually have insomnia. They've just gone to bed too early. You have to sleep in alignment with your circadian phase. Otherwise, you're going to, and that's what you were talking about earlier. Sleeping in late, we all know that that's a problem. Sometimes going to bed too early can be a problem, too. It's kind of like getting on the train at the right time.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that there's another piece to that, and there's a trauma piece. There's many of us who might urinate at night because of anxiety or have difficulty calming ourselves in the midst of activity, somehow suddenly feel more calm when everyone else is sleeping and it's a great time to work. I'd like for you to watch that, because that's a trauma symptom and an anxiety symptom, and that needs to be held very lovingly, because I think that staying up at night ultimately doesn't really serve us.
I have a couple of young couples in my family who are letting their infants cry if they're waking up before, say, 3 or 4 hours for a feeding. They simply let them cry rather than adjusting to their schedule. And these are fairly young, you know, babies. Do you have any input? There seems to be a trend or a book or something out there that is feeding this interesting. It's so foreign to me to treat a small infant and not, you know, meet its needs for food when it needs it.
So you do need to come back in January for Ariel's panel, because I think the building resiliency is such a developmental process. You know, in pediatrics, thoughts have come and gone, including about breastfeeding and not breastfeeding. So I am now relying fairly heavily on the work that's being done by people like Dan Siegel out in Stanford, the neuropsychiatrists who are working with attachment and who feel that what builds resiliency in young children and in infants is that their needs are attuned to and met.
Would you please repeat the question so everyone...
So the question is, what do we do in daylight savings time? This is kind of like, what do we do when we fly to the East Coast or Hawaii, or had an airline stewardess who got to fly anywhere she wanted in the world and did so every week and wanted me to fix her sleep. I couldn't do it. The human body is not made to do that. I mean, you can't just invert someone's time schedule and expect them to function normally immediately. biology has to, I mean, in the history of evolution, when would that have ever happened? Never. I mean, this is a recent phenomenon. So I don't think we're biologically adapted to make rapid changes. And I bring up the time, you know, time zone change, because that's an extreme example of this 1 hour change. The 1 hour change is going to be, it usually is difficult for some people, but there's really no simple way around it. You just have to, I would say, consistent daily wake time. So for the first day, you're going to feel pretty bad, but get up at the time you're supposed to and get light exposure immediately upon awakening, and that will help reset your clock. That's probably the most critical element. So awaken at the time you need to for work or whatever it is you're doing, the earliest time. Get light exposure immediately, full spectrum if you can. Don't nap. Avoid naps on that day to increase your sleep drive. It's a little difficult. You're not going to feel all that great, but it's you get through the day, and then it'll, that drive will then help you sleep through the night and actually fall asleep a little bit earlier.
I had a question. When you talked about melatonin and mentioned it was primarily really resets the morning awakening to be to, so you're more alert, can you speak how you recommend the use of melatonin then?
So generally what I recommend is you set an alarm clock and you figure out what your target sleep time is. So let's say your target sleep time is 10 p.m. and you want to be awake by 6 a.m. Then you would take the melatonin about, not about, you take it 2 hours before your target bedtime. So set an alarm so you're doing it at the exact same time each night. You shouldn't need to do this for more than maybe 2 weeks. You don't need to use melatonin long term. Your brain's perfectly capable of producing its own. What we're doing with this is just sort of tricking the brain's physiology into moving the clock a little forward. So when I say about, it will affect your ability to fall asleep at night, I didn't mean to imply that. What I really meant, but what I was saying was, for those of you who are night folks and you sleep in late, the thing you'll notice most when your internal clock starts getting advanced properly is you're not having that difficulty awakening in the morning, where you're just like snooze and snooze, and then, you know, I just need another 30 minutes and I'll be okay kind of thing. You'll want to be up at that time. So
I actually have 3 questions, but I'll try to boil it down to 2 at least. Kind of experiencing the extremity of not dreaming all the way to premonistic dreams, and I'm wondering about that, and also more about sleep apnea and how to treat that. That's really can be devastating for people.
So you feel like you don't actually have a lot of dreams? Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Well, you are. You probably just don't know it. Because when you enter REM, or what's called paradoxical sleep, you know, in the first phases of the night, you go through roughly 5 phases of a particular cycle, you know, non-REM, 1, 2, 3, and then you'll drop into REM sleep, what's called paradoxical sleep. And at that point, you're dreaming whether you know it or not. So in the first phase of the night, in fact, even in non-REM sleep, you actually can dream in that state as well. But in the first phases of the night, there's a greater incidence of delta or deep dreamless sleep and much less of REM sleep. So as the night progresses, that proportionality changes. So as you progress into, you know, the fifth phase of the night, the non-REM sleep is shorter and the REM sleep is longer. So it doesn't particularly indicate any kind of abnormality or whatnot. It's just, you know, you're simply not aware of your dreams. If you're interested in becoming aware of your dreams, there's lots of ways to do that. You can even do that pharmacologically. I mean, there's a substance that's now being studied. In fact, I just returned from a 10-day retreat with Stephen LeBerge, who's like the dean of lucid dream studies in the West. He's the one that actually proved lucid dreaming. And we, as participants, we engaged in a study using galantamine. And it's also a drug. It inhibits the breakdown of a particular neurotransmitter that's present in REM sleep. So if you really want to exercise this, there's a number of ways to do it. You know, you can take the supplement you can get. It's called galantamine, 8 milligrams. You know, you wake up 4.5 hours after you go to sleep. You take 8 milligrams of that. And when I did the study, there was a double-blind study, but this last week, and I was, you know, given the dosage. And when I got, I could absolutely clearly tell the night I got to placebo, the night I got 4 milligrams, the night I got 8. And when I got 8, I had 2 45-minute lucid dreams in a row. It helps. It's also used, you know, for things like Alzheimer's and stuff like that. There are a number of other gadgets you can use, you know, a little beyond the scope of what we're talking about here. So maybe that's enough on that. And what was the second question? I'm sorry. Oh, yeah, there we go.
So here in Colorado, we have two types of sleep apnea. We have two types everywhere, but more prevalent here. We have central sleep apnea and obstructive. Central, referring to the central nervous system. The brain normally triggers the diaphragm to contract and to breathe. At altitude, that can be a problem for some people where they're having breathing pauses because the brain's not triggering them to breathe. So central apnea is one, and that has different treatments like supplemental oxygen. There's a few other things you can do that aren't really being used, but medications can affect that. The most common, though, is the obstructive, where the airway is collapsing. So you'd want to do a proper sleep study to characterize the severity of it, because that determines what your treatment is. So if somebody has it, let's say they have exclusive sleep apnea. They don't have any sleep apnea when they're on their sides or on their stomach, but only on their back. We can treat it simply with a positional belt so they can't go to their back at night. If they have mild sleep apnea that's multiple, then their treatment options would be CPAP or a custom fabricated mandibular advancement device to bring, it's just a little mouth guard that you wear that brings your lower jaw forward so the airway doesn't collapse. Usually that doesn't work well when you're on your back, so what you've got to do is couple that with the positional belt. Keep the person on their side, bring the jaw forward, and the airway won't collapse. If they have severe sleep apnea, generally 30 pauses in their breathing per hour, so once every 2 minutes, we would have to use CPAP. It's the best treatment that we have. It keeps the airway open regardless of where the obstruction is. So,
folks, it's getting late. I think we should probably stop now. I want to thank you for coming and thank our panel for such a great presentation. Remember to like us on Facebook and have a safe trip home.